Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
A couple of warnings before we begin. This episode is about black and brown boys wrongly accused of an awful attack of a young white woman. So trigger warnings for physical and sexual violence and systemic racism are in order. Also, I will neither entertain nor tolerate racist comments. Some of you seem to get really angry whenever I tell any kind of story about people of color. This is not the podcast for you. You are not welcome here, and my aim is not to make you comfortable. So if you think you might get angry because I'm talking about young black and brown men, please move on. I assure you there are plenty of other podcasts that cater to your worldview. On the other hand, if you're willing to actually look history in the face and possibly learn something, welcome. How many wrongfully convicted people does it take to make reform? How many lives must be needlessly interrupted before the powers that be will admit that the system is broken? How are there so many stories like this one? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I have a child who just turned 13. My child has ADHD, like parent, like child. Last night, we had a huge revelation about homework. For months now, we have been accusing them of lying to us about their assignments. I was talking to my therapist about it, and I said I don't understand what their assignments are in order to help them, and she said, I don't think they do either. So last night, when I found out they had once again done the wrong assignment, I said, you lied to me again. And they hung their head and nodded. But then, when I asked them what their assignment was, like my therapist said, they didn't know. And I realized in that moment that they weren't lying. They just didn't know. I'm going to skip over the part where I wept for half an hour because I felt so bad for accusing them of lying when they were just drowning in information they didn't understand. I wonder what would happen to my kid if they were arrested and brought down to the police station, accused of something awful, and interrogated without me there. How long would it take them, with their executive functioning issues, to buckle and admit to something they didn't do? How long would it take for my kid to become so confused that they truly didn't even know what was truth and what was fiction? How long would it take any kid still growing and figuring out who they are to believe the word of someone telling them who they are from behind a spotlight and badge? New York City in the late 80s was a city on the cusp of major economic and political change. There were pretty stark socioeconomic disparities, with big hair, shoulder pads, money, and cocaine fueling places like the Financial District downtown, and decades of disenfranchisement, redlining, racism, and crack, the less expensive yet chemically identical drug to cocaine, fueling disadvantaged neighborhoods like East Harlem. The city's iconic Central Park's northernmost edge was surrounded by the Upper East and West Side and East and West Harlem. These were all different neighborhoods in terms of their racial and economic demographics. They still are, to some degree, though more and more no one can afford to live anywhere in New York City, let alone that close to the park, which is undeniably beautiful. Anyway, on the night of April 19th, 1989, starting at around 9 p.m., about 30 kids, all boys under the age of 17, were roaming through the northern tip of Central Park, causing a considerable amount of mayhem. I'm no sociologist, but I think it's safe to say these were bored teenagers with not too much to do, who were egging each other on. The kids were harassing passersby in increasingly violent ways, until before too long, some were physically assaulting passersby. As one of the members of the group, 15-year-old Yousef Salam, would later recall in an interview with the New York Times, quote, "You go from hanging out with friends, thinking that you're going to, you know, go skateboarding in the park or walk around the lake, to mayhem. It's almost like moths being drawn to a fire," end quote. I'm fairly certain we can all relate to this in some way, being a part of some dumbass thing with a group of kids that got out of hand. I know I can. Perhaps it didn't get this out of hand, but I can see a world in which it easily could have. In the span of about an hour or so, the kids who'd broken off into smaller groups attacked 9 different park-goers. In a piece for ABC News in 2019, one member of the group, Tony Montalvo, recalled, quote, "Basically, we took over that whole park, just walked down the street and beat people up. We were walking on the road towards downtown, and somebody recognized an older man walking across the road, and he had a bag in his hand, and then a bunch, you know, other kids went punching him, kicking him, and all that," end quote. Local police recalled the night beginning chaotically, with a lot of people calling in the various attacks. The sequence of events, according to victim statements, went something like this. At 9:05 p.m., Michael Vigna was riding his bike through the park when he said he encountered the group of boys. The New York Times would later report that in his testimony, quote, "He had marked his pacing time from a big clock in Columbus Circle and had calculated that it was 9:05 when he was hassled by a group of boys on East Drive, west of the Conservatory Garden, around 105th Street. One threw a punch as he rode past," end quote. Between 9:10 and 9:15 p.m., Antonio Diaz encountered the group and was knocked to the ground, kicked and dragged from the roadway to the grass. The boys took his food and a beer he was carrying in a paper bag. At 9:15 p.m., Gerald Malone and Patricia Dean were on their second lap around the park on a tandem bike when the group tried to block their path. According to an ABC News piece, Patricia said, quote, "We saw this whole line of kids. I remember thinking, I wonder why they're here so late," end quote. One of the kids allegedly yelled, "Get them," at which point, according to Jerry, the group began chasing them. Patricia recalled, quote, "It was actually terrifying. They were ripping at my arms and legs and clothing. As a woman, you immediately wonder what's going to happen," end quote. The pair eventually managed to escape the group. And then, sometime between 9:25 and 9:40 p.m., David Lewis, a banker, was attacked as he jogged around the reservoir. He sprinted away and headed for the Central Park Police headquarters on the 85th Street transverse. At 9:30 p.m., Robert Garner was attacked by the group on his second lap around the reservoir, a popular jogging path in the park. Around 9:45 to 9:50, schoolteacher and former Marine John Laughlin apparently saw the group doing what he believed was beating someone else up. Why he appears uncertain, I don't know. John was then hit from behind and knocked unconscious. A few minutes after, or possibly at the same time, another jogger, David Good, encountered the group and had a stick thrown at him as he ran. John Laughlin was then found by police at 9:55, bloodied and dazed. The officer who found him, Eric Reynolds, later recalled, quote, "The victim looked like his head got dunked in a bucket of blood. He was beaten so badly," end quote. At about 10:30, officers spotted about 20 teens leaving the park. After a pursuit on foot, officers arrested a small handful of kids, including Kevin Richardson, 14, and Raymond Santana, 14. By the next morning, they'd brought in 15-year-old Antron McCray and 15-year-old Yousef Salam. In a show of support that was both incredibly commendable and incredibly naive, 16-year-old Corey Wise went to the station voluntarily as a show of support for his friend, Yousef. This brave gesture of friendship would cost Corey more than a decade of his life. Strangers, this is definitely not suitable for work or kids, but stop what you're doing and listen closely, because Balesa and I are giving away free spicy toys or gift cards for toys to every single one of you. That's right. Everyone who signs up wins something. Balesa is a by women, for everyone company that's completely flipping the script on sexual wellness. And now they're hooking you up. You've definitely seen Balesa's viral toys all over your For Your page, like the rose. It blew up for a reason. This little flower-shaped suction toy is iconic. Or their famous Whisper collection, you know, the very first fully silent vibrators. If you live with roommates, parents, or even your partner sleeping right next to you, these toys are silent, without compromising power. Or their new Pebble Pro. They just one-upped their best-selling Pebble with a stronger, smarter, and seriously spicy redesign. Balesa somehow figured out how to engineer a one-stop pleasure shop with three interchangeable heads. It sucks, it thumps, it licks, it vibrates. I'm speechless. I have quite a collection of Balesa toys. My favorite is the Air Vibe, but the thump is up there too. And of course, I had to hook all of you up. So my friends at Balesa and I are sending out free toys or gift cards for toys to everyone who signs up. You heard that right. Every single one of you wins something. Just click the link in the episode description or head to bbvibes.com/daisy. That's bbvibes.com/daisy. While Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Antron McRae, Yusef Salam, and Corey Wise, because police seized on Corey's integrity and placed him under arrest as well, were being questioned at about 1:30 in the morning, two construction workers walking home from their shift heard moaning coming from a ravine off the Central Park jogging path. They discovered a woman on the ground. She had been beaten so badly it was assumed at first she wouldn't survive. In fact, she had lost almost 80% of her blood, which I didn't even know was possible without dying. The woman had no ID on her, but the next morning when she didn't show up for work, co-workers, having heard about the attack, went to police with an awful hunch that the woman who was attacked was their friend and co-worker. A friend ID'd her at about noon that day. It was 28-year-old stockbroker Trisha Miley. Back at the scene of her attack, investigators determined that Trisha had been attacked on the jogging path and then dragged about 200 feet into a wooded area where she endured a vicious attack. Initial reports said the attack occurred sometime around 10:05 p.m. and that, according to a piece by David E. Pitt in The Times on April 22nd, just a few days after the attack, doctors discovered five, quote, deep stab wounds on her head, and that she had been beaten with fists, a lead pipe, a rock, and a brick. One unnamed source said the stab wounds may have injured her brain. The Times also printed this, quote, "The woman also had a gash on one of her thighs, suffered when one of the thugs cut off her clothes," end quote. In fact, she had not been stabbed in the head. Where or how that information came about, I don't know. "One of the thugs," Pitt wrote, because even though Trisha was in a coma and had not, therefore, been able to offer any information about her attackers, just days after the attack, police had announced to the media that they had five suspects in jail after what I will generously call questionable interrogations. More on that later. The media took this information and ran headlines announcing the charges with nary a qualifying alleged to be seen anywhere. The Times headline on April 22nd read, quote, "Joggers attackers terrorized at least nine in 2 hours," end quote. After all, they said, the kids admitted to being part of the marauding band of teens that were wreaking havoc on innocent passersby the night of Trisha's attack. They called it wilding, a phrase the press repeated again and again. On May 1st, just 12 days after the awful attack on Trisha Miley, Donald Trump, the least racist person there is in the world, took out a full-page ad in the Saturday New York Times that read, quote, "Bring back the death penalty, bring back the police." In it, he proclaimed his hatred for, quote, "muggers and murderers," and longed for the good old days when cops could toss thugs out of diners where respectable people were just trying to eat their lunch. And while he didn't come out and name the young men or refer specifically to the case, most people knew this was a reaction, at least in part, to the crime of which the boys who would become known as the Central Park Five were accused of. This was, of course, before their trials even began. Right at this very moment, I won't get into the devastating impact of decades of disenfranchisement of black people that both Donald and his father Fred engaged in, or his father's suspected involvement with the KKK. But as always, I encourage you to pause and follow your curiosity by reading further on these matters yourself. Anyway. The Times was not the only paper in which Trump bought these kinds of ads. He bought them in The Post, The Daily News, and Newsday at an estimated total cost of about $85,000. Could you imagine the impact that kind of money could make in a young person's life? After hours of interrogation, the boys confessed to attacking Trisha, though not to raping her. All, that is, except for Yusef Salam, who never gave a videotaped confession nor a signed confession. Though one of the detectives who interrogated him claimed that he did confess to being there, but not participating. To be clear, there's no official record of this confession. Regardless, Salam, along with the four others, were indicted and awaiting trial a mere week after the attack. General opinion based on media coverage and the apparent fact, according to the press, that the five boys had confessed, was that they were guilty. One particularly wild note, in my opinion, is that within the initial swarm of media attention on the case, the New York Times published the boys' addresses and where they went to school. I cannot believe that this was accepted practice at the time. Not only were these children supposed to be presumed innocent until proven guilty by a jury of their peers, but they were children. And even if they were guilty, what is the general public supposed to do with their addresses? Why would anyone need that information? Why would a jury even need that information? It's worth noting that this was, it seems, standard practice back then. In an awful case in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, in August of that same year, a group of 10 to 30 white teenagers attacked and killed a young black man who was apparently lost, and the Times published the suspects' addresses. They did not, however, refer to any of them as thugs. New York law at the time, according to a piece in the Village Voice, went as follows, quote, "Penetration was necessary before the crime of sexual assault rises to that of rape. In the case of a group of attackers, penetration by only one person, though again not necessarily ejaculation, is enough to implicate the rest of the group in a rape," end quote. I hate to imagine the conversations that were had around whether or not the perpetrator had to come to completion in order for the act to be considered rape. The notion is beyond the scope of my comprehension. At any rate, Sidney H. Schoenberg, the author of the piece in The Voice, implies that the rape charge was added, despite lack of evidence, because, quote, "otherwise in this case, the five could only be charged with other crimes committed during the wilding." The indictments did charge them with several other crimes, such as assault, robbery, and riot, but the pivot of the prosecution's case and the primary focus was always the rape, end quote. An interesting point here is that Trisha was clearly beaten and easily could have died, but the prosecutor's focus seemed to be far more about the rape than the attempted murder. I'm not really qualified to go into the intricacies of systemic misogyny, but there's something in this whole mess about how a woman's honor is somehow more important than her life. One wonders if the sexual component of this crime were missing, if the powers that be would have cared as much. Indeed, according to law reporter Timothy Sullivan in his 1992 book Unequal Verdicts, while the jury deliberated in the second of the two trials for the boys, Detective Thomas McKenna spoke to the press, Quote, if we don't get a rape conviction, said Detective McKenna, we lost the case. A reporter asked whether a conviction on attempted murder, technically a higher count, would not be considered a victory. No, said McKenna, it had to be a rape conviction. Detective John Taglioni nodded in agreement, end quote. But unless I'm wrong, none of the boys confessed to the actual rape. They all only said they were there, or at the most, helped by holding Trisha down or groping her. Then again, seeing as how the law stated that one could be found guilty for rape even if they didn't engage in the act at all, it seems the prosecution just had to prove that one of the boys must have perpetrated the physical act. I guess it didn't matter which one of the boys, while the others were guilty by association. And this view of all of them as one would set the stage for their trials. Strangers, this episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQ Bar protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe mushroom coffees are the delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel you need to win your day. I love IQ Bar's sugar-free hydration mixes. They add flavor and all the electrolytes without the sweetness. And of course, their protein bars are my go-to. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ Bar's brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. Their ultimate sampler pack includes all three. IQ Bar products are packed with clean, delicious ingredients that keep you physically and mentally fit, like magnesium, lion's mane, and more. IQ Bar's plant-based protein bars are the smarter snack choice. There are plenty of flavor combinations to choose from across all IQ Bar products. I like anything with chocolate chips because I'm basically a child, but the fruit-flavored ones slap too. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ Bar products, including the Ultimate Sampler Pack, plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text STRANGE to 64,000. That's STRANGE to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Prosecution split the boys up into two groups. The first trial was for Antron McCray, Yusef Salam, and Raymond Santana. I don't really know their reasoning for this grouping, especially considering Yusef hadn't confessed. A layperson, such as myself, would assume they would have wanted to go after the boys who had confessed, but I thankfully don't live inside the minds of late 80s, early 90s era prosecutors. At any rate, with a lack of evidence or victim ID, Trisha had no recollection of the attack when she did come out of her coma, prosecution only had the confessions to rely on, but also claimed that hairs found on two of the alleged perpetrators belonged to Trisha. And how, they argued, could those hairs have gotten there without the boys being present at the attack? Trisha testified in both trials. She was trying to maintain anonymity and didn't have much to offer of evidentiary value, having no recollection of the attack. She was compelled by the DA's office to testify in what I can only surmise was a play on the jury's sympathy. Regardless of the impact of the attack on her physical and emotional health, which was, of course, significant, her condition had no factual bearing on the guilt or innocence of the defendants. But by now, we all know that both sides of a trial rely on far more than facts to try to win a jury over. Indeed, Corey's lawyer, in a real this fucking guy move, tried grilling Trisha on her sexual history and habits, a move to which Corey's co-defendant, Kevin's lawyer, objected and tried to use as grounds for a mistrial. Corey's lawyer tried to imply that Trisha knew her attacker and that the attack happened earlier than police had reported. In fact, the attack did happen earlier than police had reported. This was determined using a process of establishing timelines for all the victims of the various attacks, including Trisha's that night in the park. But in the first trial, Raymond's lawyer didn't want to bring the time discrepancy up because he said, quote, "We didn't say no when the jogger was raped. My client was on 96th Street mugging someone else. That would have been self-defeating," end quote. I mean, no, it wouldn't have been. It would have meant your client was admitting to having committed a much lesser crime at the time he was being accused of rape and attempted murder. If he was somewhere else at the time, he couldn't possibly have been where police and prosecutors say he was. Again, I thankfully don't really know how any of this actually works, but it seems to me that it might have behooved the defense team to call the person or people who were being mugged at the same time Trisha was being attacked to identify the defendant, proving he had been somewhere else. Prosecutors also claimed that tests on DNA found on Trisha and on a sock at the scene were inconclusive and that it could not rule out the boys. On the stand, however, according to the piece in The Voice, FBI Laboratory Special Agent Dwight Adams, a witness for the prosecution, readily admitted under cross-examination, quote, that while there was no DNA match with the blood samples from any of the defendants or possible suspects in the Wilding, or the sample from the jogger's boyfriend, some firm conclusions could be made. True, there was no match, Adams said, but all 14 of the DNA samples could be excluded as belonging to the person or persons who penetrated the victim in Central Park that night. The FBI expert explained that in DNA testing, it is easier to exclude than to match. He said the weak pattern obtained from the cervix and the stronger pattern found on the sock, though not as complete as needed for a match, were nonetheless clear and strong enough to determine that they definitely did not belong to any of the 14 people whose blood was tested. End quote. Furthermore, Adams said that both DNA samples came from the same person. In the piece for The Voice, Schonberg noted, quote, the FBI disclosures about the DNA evidence should have exploded a bomb in the heart of the prosecution's case, end quote. Apparently, they also pointed to semen found inside Kevin's shorts. I'll just say he was a teenage boy. But it seems the apparent confessions of the boys overrode any hard evidence. As a piece in New York Magazine put it, quote, beyond the initial shocking impact, the confessions grew in importance as forensic evidence failed to materialize. No blood or DNA tests tied the five to the jogger. Hairs found on Richardson's clothes were said to be consistent with those of the jogger, but it was precious little residue considering that five people were accused of beating and raping a woman in a muddy ravine, end quote. During the second trial, according to a piece in the Times, Corey suddenly yelled out, no, 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 after the prosecutor, Elizabeth Lederer, had completed her opening statements. It's false. It's a lie, he said, referring to Ms. Lederer's accusation that, among other things, he had told police that he had held the victim down and fondled her leg while others raped her. Corey yelled out, that woman, she's lying. Apparently, Corey became increasingly upset during Lederer's opening statement and was rocking back and forth in his seat and crying. Before the jury was completely out of the room for a recess, he began, quote, pounding his fist into his forehead and screaming, I can't take it anymore. Kevin's lawyer, Howard Diller, tried to use this as grounds for a mistrial, but the judge denied it and warned Corey that he would be removed from the courtroom permanently if he had another outburst. The prosecution then announced a surprise witness. Melody Jackson, a friend of Corey's, had apparently come forward with a claim that he'd called her from prison 3 months after the attack and confessed. She claimed she said to him, quote, I don't believe what I've been hearing about you, that you had sex with that woman. She said that Mr. Wise repeated at least 3 times, no, no, I didn't have sex with her. Did he say anything else? Asked Assistant District Attorney Elizabeth Lederer. Yes, he did, the witness replied. All I did, Mel, was hold her legs and fondle her, she quoted Mr. Wise as saying, end quote. According to the New York Times, both Corey and Kevin were heard muttering liar and traitor during Melody's testimony. Corey's lawyer, quote, challenged Ms. Jackson's testimony, asking her why she had waited over a year to reveal her conversation with Mr. Wise and how she knew for sure it was Mr. Wise who was calling. He asked her sarcastically, how much are you getting for coming into this courtroom? Nothing, nothing, Miss Jackson shot back as anger replaced her tears. I had no choice, she insisted. I was subpoenaed. Mr. Moore glared at her and snapped, "You're making this up because you want to be a star witness. Isn't that why you came here today?" "I don't know," she replied. End quote. Apparently, the prosecution team wouldn't reveal how they became aware of Melody's claim, but said, quote, several other people had overheard the conversation. I don't know about you, stranger, but I don't think I've ever heard a 16-year-old boy use the word fondle. All five boys in their two separate trials were found guilty. Antron, Youssef, Kevin, and Raymond were sentenced to 5 to 10 years in a juvenile detention facility, while Corey was sent to a regular adult prison, on account he was definitely an adult at 16 years old at the time of the attack, for a 15-year sentence. Don't forget, as far as anyone knows, the only way Corey showed up on police's radar to begin with was that he went to the station with his friend in a show of support. Ironically enough, though, sending Corey to Rikers, an infamous adult prison in New York City, would prove to be his saving grace. Strangers, as some of you may have figured out by now, I am going through second puberty, and boy are my hormones tired. Everything feels off, especially my sleep. But I didn't want to add yet another prescription medication to address my sleep issues, so I added Batch Nighttime CBD Gummies instead. Batch Nighttime Gummies are formulated specifically for restorative sleep, the kind that actually lets you wake up feeling human again. Clean ingredients, no pharmaceutical dependency, and designed for those whose sleep quality has quietly become a casualty of everything else they're managing. Batch is a Wisconsin-based hemp wellness brand founded by chemical engineers, people who actually understand formulations, not just marketing. It's a company that shows you exactly what's in the product and why. If your sleep is wrecked, your mood is unpredictable, and your doctor's best advice was basically, "Have you tried yoga?" you're not alone. And you're not crazy. Perimenopause hits years before most expect it, and the medical system is genuinely not built to help you through it. A lot of us are finding our way through, and hemp wellness is a big part of that conversation right now. Right now, Batch is offering 30% off site-wide, and yes, that applies to subscriptions too, so you can lock in that discount on your monthly supply. Go to hellobatch.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. A few years into his sentence at Rikers Island, Corey met a man named Mateus Reyes. Reyes was serving a 33-year-to-life sentence at Rikers after being found guilty in 1991 for 4 rapes and the murder of a pregnant woman. The media had dubbed him the East Side Rapist. In 2002, Reyes met Corey in jail and apparently had a come-to-Jesus moment. He had, he said, found God in prison, and meeting one of the men accused of the crime he committed, was compelled to come forward and confess that he had been the one responsible for the horrific attack on Trisha Miley. 3 of the 4 rapes for which he was found guilty and the murder all happened after he'd attacked Trisha Miley. Police were aware of the earlier attacks, including an attack in the same area of the park 2 nights before Trisha's attack, in which the victim was able to describe her attacker. And yet, somehow, Reyes never appeared on their radar in the investigation of Trisha's attack. Detective Mike Sheehan, who'd participated in the investigation of the 5 boys convicted in Trisha's attack, told New York Magazine, quote, "Reyes gave no hint he had anything to do with the Central Park jogger attack. This was not a guy to have sex as a part of a group of people. Totally different MO. The guy was a hostage taker. He wanted total control by himself. And as he told me, describing what he did with Lourdes Gonzalez, we made love. Not like I fucked her. It was I made love in the sleeping room. The park was not his thing. Obviously, now we know he was there, but there was no reason to suspect him in the case at all." End quote. Reyes's confession included details that were not released to the public, and his DNA matched the DNA collected from Trisha's attack. In light of the new evidence, in December 2002, 13 years after the boys, who were now men, had been found guilty, a judge voided their sentences. The men had already served their sentences by the time they were exonerated, but the decision to vacate their convictions meant they were now no longer considered felons, nor did they have to continue to report to authorities every 3 months, and they were taken off the sex offenders registry. The men were exonerated and free to live out the rest of their lives. But, of course, that wouldn't be the end of the story. Despite the judge's decision to vacate their sentences, some people could not let go of the opinion that the five convicted young men, at this point, were still guilty. The new information, they said, was just evidence of a sixth attacker. This, despite Reyes' confession to attacking her by himself, and, as stated by Detective Sheehan, his M.O. as a lone attacker. He didn't even know the five boys who'd been convicted. But facts and evidence are hard for some people to process, especially when it requires them to admit to having been wrong. And even though now some of us are slightly more savvy about confessions and aware how common it is for people to give false ones, some people find that concept hard to wrap their heads around. Why, they ask, would someone admit to committing a crime they did not commit? But we know that police commonly use coercive tactics to get the answers they want. And in a city in the middle of a crime wave, where tensions were really high, I'm sure there was pressure placed on local police departments and the DA's office to get convictions and close cases. We know, for example, that police can lie and mislead. Indeed, Detective McKenna openly admitted to misleading Yusuf Salam during his interrogation, according to the Village Voice. Quote, "On the stand, McKenna, a detective for 20 years, openly acknowledged that he had used a ruse on the night after the rape to get Salam's confession. The boy, McKenna said, at first repeatedly denied having been in Central Park. Then, went McKenna's testimony, he, the detective, made the following untrue statement to Salam. Look, I don't care if you tell me anything. I don't care what you say to me. We have fingerprints on the jogger's pants. They're satin. They're a very smooth surface, and we've been able to get fingerprints off of them. I'm just going to compare your prints to the prints we have on the pants, and if they match up, you don't have to tell me anything, because you're going down for rape." End quote. Needless to say, they did not have fingerprints. According to McKenna's testimony, Yusuf then admitted to having been present. He allegedly calmly admitted to hitting her with an iron bar and touching her breasts. Quote, "As described by McKenna, his trick playing on Salam is, under present case law, quite legal, as are many other kinds of law enforcement distortions, misdirections, and veiled, and sometimes not so veiled, suggestions that leniency will be granted if the witness is forthcoming. The justice system's premise for accepting these stratagems is that an innocent person will not falsely incriminate himself." End quote. But of course, we know that innocent people do falsely incriminate themselves. And let's please not forget that these were children, and many hours of their interrogations were not recorded. And so, when all five boys claimed they were screamed at, or threatened, or worn down, and that they were questioned for hours without parents or legal representation, these things weren't shown to the jury because they conveniently happened before the cameras were turned on. Not only that, but at least two of the boys demonstrated some pretty severe learning disabilities. While I'm not one to place much weight on IQ scores because I think they're racist, I think that when a teenager is reading at a second or fourth grade level, as was the case with both Corey and Antron, one has to factor in their capability of comprehension. A child, no matter their intelligence level, who is being interrogated for hours, without, I might imagine, being given real food, is not going to be hard to break. Hell, my kid thought they were lying when it turned out they just didn't understand what was being asked of them. And the stakes there were much lower, to say the least. Recently, my partner Kurt claimed authorship of a joke that was, in fact, my joke. But after just a few minutes of him seriously doubting my memory, I too began seriously doubting my memory. But McKenna's admission that he had lied to Yusuf actually gained him credibility with the jurors. They were like, he was willing to admit to lying, therefore he must be honest. Girl, he was allowed to lie. It also didn't seem to matter to jurors in either trial that some facts in the boys' statements either didn't match up with each other or didn't match up with reality. The statements given by the boys were contradictory from the outset and did not reflect the active evidence of the rape. Perhaps most importantly, evidence demonstrated only one rapist, only one DNA profile found, which meant we were to believe that five young teenagers viciously assaulted a woman and left literally no physical evidence. The times in the confessions were not accurate. Some of the boys got the location wrong. Some of the boys gave details about the rape that objectively did not happen. Stabbing, dragging, etc. Some of the confessions made seemed to have more details that applied to other attacks made during the wilding spree and not the rape. This is especially important as the details were not publicly available at the time of the confessions. Or, as Jim Dwyer and Kevin Flynn wrote in a 2002 piece for The Times, quote, "The record does show that much of what the youth said about the rape was wrong, including when, where, and how it took place. Indeed, their description of the location, the victim's clothing, and other details makes it seem, in retrospect, almost as if they were talking about another crime," end quote. According to the Netflix docuseries When They See Us by Ava DuVernay, Corey would later claim that he was coerced into confessing by Linda Fairstein from the Manhattan DA's sex crime unit. The piece in The Voice reported that Fairstein, quote, "bullied and stalled and blocked the mother and two friends of one suspect, Yusuf Salam, from gaining access to him." Fairstein's apparent purpose was to keep the suspect under wraps because she had been informed by the interrogating detective that the questioning was in a delicate phase where Salam had begun to make some admissions. A short while later, Fairstein realized she could not bar the mother any longer, and the angry parent halted the interrogation, end quote. If that had been my mother, I'm telling you, the hell she would have wrathed upon the New York DA's office. Lord. She was friends with famous civil rights attorney William Kunstler, which is, of course, not to say that any of these kids' moms didn't want to wrath hell. The circumstances were quite different from mine. Anyway. Strangers, if you're hosting this grilling season, you already know people remember the food. And having high-quality meat makes all the difference. And don't be like that lady I saw on Instagram who boils her burgers. Honestly. ButcherBox helps you show up with confidence, whether it's steaks, burgers, or chicken, everything you need to make it a great cookout. Instead of making last-minute grocery runs and hoping for the best, ButcherBox keeps you stocked with high-quality options year-round. So when it's time to grill, you're already set. But you don't need to be a grill master to appreciate high-quality, clean proteins. ButcherBox delivers over 100 premium protein options straight to your door, from grass-fed beef to wild-caught seafood. It's all raised and sourced the right way. No antibiotics, no added hormones, no fillers. Just clean, reliable protein you can feel good serving. I'm telling you, having a freezer packed with healthy proteins makes deciding what's for dinner so much easier. I love their selection of wild-caught fish. I always have some salmon, shrimp, or panko-crusted cod pieces. They make for delicious fish tacos. And it all ships free with recipes, grilling tips, and exclusive deals. So whether you're a beginner or a grill master, you've got everything you need to make it a great season. As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life. Plus, $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/unexplained. That's right, your choice of free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life, plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/unexplained. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Obviously, the police and prosecutors disagree that they used coercive tactics and insist they followed the rules. Prosecutor Elizabeth Lederer doubled down in an interview with The Times, insisting that, quote, "hairs from the jogger were found on two of the suspects. How could that have happened if they were not involved?" end quote. But that evidence had already been proven false when earlier that year, quote, advanced DNA tests showed that those hairs had not come from the victim. DNA tests also found Mr. Reyes' semen and no one else's on swabs taken from the victim and a sock found near the scene of the rape, end quote. It seems implausible to me that Lederer wouldn't have known that DNA testing had proven the hairs didn't belong to Tricia. Maybe she forgot? At any rate, if you say something enough times in the press, it muddies the waters and makes it hard for people to grasp on to whatever the truth actually is. Linda Fairstein, the sex crimes investigator who helped lead the investigation, wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal claiming that DuVernay had grossly misrepresented her in her Netflix docuseries about the case. She maintains that her side of the story, that there was nothing coercive or nefarious about the investigations, is backed up by the written record in the case. But, of course, there is a definite air of they said, she said about this whole thing, because it's hard to know how much of the written record reflects the actual truth. In an atmosphere of quotas and top-down expectations for closed cases, it's not hard to imagine that those in power might engage in less than truthful tactics to get the answers they need. We know from Detective McKenna's own testimony that lies were de rigueur in interrogations. We also know that people can jump to conclusions depending on implicit and explicit bias. Sometimes people truly don't think they're doing anything wrong when in fact they are. In 2002, all five exonerated men sued the city of New York. Then Mayor Mike Bloomberg spoke at a press conference saying, quote, "As far as I can tell, the NYPD did exactly what they should have done a number of years ago when the terrible incident took place. If we see any reason to think that we acted inappropriately, Police Commissioner Kelly will certainly take appropriate measures. But so far, we believe that the NYPD did act appropriately," end quote. However, about a year later, new mayor Bill de Blasio issued this statement, quote, "An injustice was done, and we have a moral obligation to respond to that injustice. I think that the way we've processed was with an understanding that that had to be rectified in a way that made sense, in a way that was mindful and careful, but I think we're on the right track. And I think the moral issue is quite clear and obviously was made clear by the court decisions in recent years," end quote. The five men received a combined settlement of $41 million. Trump doubled down on his thinly veiled attack ads on the accused in a presidential debate with Kamala Harris in 2024, during which he said the boys, quote, "admitted, they said they pled guilty. And I said, well, if they pled guilty, they badly hurt a person, killed a person ultimately," end quote. On top of this being gibberish, none of them killed a person ultimately. No one was killed in any of the attacks that night, and none of them pleaded guilty. In response to these remarks, Yousef Salam, Raymond Santana, Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, and Corey Wise sued Trump for making false and defamatory statements against them. In June of 2025, a judge threw out the latest in several attempts by Trump to have the lawsuit dismissed. It looks like a verdict is still pending. Yousef Salam would later say, quote, "I look at Donald Trump and I understand him as a representation of a symptom of America. We were convicted because of the color of our skin. People thought the worst of us. And this is all because of prominent New Yorkers, especially Donald Trump," end quote. Yousef is married and has children. In 2016, then-President Obama awarded him a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2021, he published a memoir, Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice, which calls for prison reform. And in November of 2023, he won a seat on the city council in a West Harlem district. Corey Wise still lives in New York City, where he works as a public speaker and criminal justice activist. He donated $190,000 in 2015 to the Innocence Project at the University of Colorado, which then changed its name to the Corey Wise Innocence Project at Colorado Law in his honor. He and Yousef are still good friends, and in an interview for The Times, Yousef said, quote, "We had all gone through hell. But when I saw this series, I immediately realized that we were in paradise compared to the hell that Corey was in. I went to jail and I was able to get a college degree. He never got an opportunity to breathe. End quote. Kevin Richardson also dedicates his time working with the Innocence Project, advocating for the rights of others who've been wrongly accused. Raymond Santana has become a filmmaker and launched a clothing line called Park Madison NYC in 2018. He dedicated a portion of the proceeds for t-shirts bearing the first names of the five wrongly accused to the Innocence Project. Antron McRae moved to the South, where he married and is quietly raising his children. In 2018, thanks in part to Youssef's advocacy, according to the Innocence Project, quote, a New York state law took effect that mandates law enforcement agencies statewide to video record interrogations of people accused of serious non-drug felonies, such as homicides and violent sex offenses. The requirement applies to all custodial interrogations that occur in police stations, correctional facilities, prosecutors' offices, and holding areas. Failure to record interrogations in such cases could result in a court determining that a confession is inadmissible as evidence, end quote. Which perhaps doesn't put to bed the question of whether interrogations were handled properly in this specific case, but it certainly indicates the investigative team was acting within the law when they conducted hours and hours of interrogation before turning on the video, which is absurd. Trisha Miley made a remarkable recovery and went on to become an advocate for survivors of sexual assault, brain injuries, and other trauma. In 2003, she published a memoir titled I Am the Central Park Jogger, officially revealing her identity, which she had largely tried to keep secret till then. She had trouble reconciling the apparent innocence of the five boys who'd been convicted of her attack, which makes sense, as unfortunate as it is. I'm not sure I can fault her for any feelings or opinions she has about her own attack. The five men whose lives were interrupted after a night of poor decision-making combined with poor timing, to put it mildly, prefer to be known as the Central Park Exonerated. On December 19, 2022, three of the five men helped unveil the new name of the entrance to Central Park closest to where the awful attack took place in 1989. Now, when you enter the park at 110th between 5th Avenue and Malcolm X Boulevard on a beautiful spring evening, you'll see families picnicking, toddlers chasing the geese, and joggers making their circuit around the reservoir. You'll pass the engraved words on the park wall, Gate of the Exonerated. If you find yourself there, stranger, take a moment to remember the five boys and one young woman whose lives were forever changed that night and whose stories still make ripples across that great city. Their stories reflect greater ills our country still reckons with today: systemic racism, mass incarceration, violence toward women, and the way the pride of people in power can lead to the unconstitutional treatment of marginalized people. Encountering history is the first step. The next is to interrogate it. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. In August of 1993, seven highly experienced hikers set out on a hike in the mountains of Siberia. Only one would survive the experience that to this day remains a mystery: the Kamar Dabin incident. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched by Joe Guardet and written by me, with editorial help and sound mixing and engineering by Becca DiGregorio. I will be taking a break from releasing new episodes in June to get myself caught up. I'll be releasing some greatest hits. Please be sure to tune in, and I'll see you in July for season 6. If you have an idea for an episode or want to submit a question for an Ask Me Anything episode, head to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Eventually, I need an assistant. You can follow me on social media at Daisy Egan or follow the show at SNU Pod and Grab Bag Collab. Stay strange.